Those who speak with understanding must be strong in what is common to all, right? Now, those who speak with understanding in the antonomasia are the wise. So, if you understand what Heraclitus is saying there, then you realize that Thomas being called the common doctor, that's really a very what? Great title, right? And in some ways, although it's not as flattering as the title of angelic doctor, you know, in terms of his importance, right, for learning. As I say to the students, the life of the mind together is impossible without something we have in common. Mm-hmm. And in the case of the teacher and the student has to be led by the teacher from things that the student knows already. To see some things that the teacher sees the student doesn't see yet. But then those things that the student knows already that the teacher uses to lead him to something new, the teacher's got to have those too, right? So only on the basis of something that is common to the teacher and the student is teaching at all possible. Mm-hmm. And then if you have, you know, a conversation that's not between, say, a teacher and a student, but more between two more equals, you might say, right? As you know, when we converse, we often disagree, right? And we get nowhere if I just, you know, say you're off base there because you don't agree with me, and you return the compliment. The only way we can do is try to get back to something we both have in common that we can use to decide whether you or I are right where we disagree, right? Mm-hmm. So no life of the mind together is possible without some kind of a common knowledge, common understanding. And if you look at the whole fragment of Heraclitus, he says, those who speak with understanding must be strong, what is common to all, as much as a city is strong in its law, even more so because the law of the city is fed by one divine law, which is more than sufficient for all. But notice the beautiful comparison he makes there. Huh? He's saying, making a comparison between the life of the mind and life together in the city. They're two different lives, in a sense. But is life together in the city possible without some kind of common law? So you guys are following the law of driving the right side of the street, and I'm following the law on the left side, right? We're going to have chaos in our society, right? And if we have common laws about law, I mean about time and so on, right? We'd have a problem. And then, but then he goes on to say, you know, that the law of the city is fed by the divine law. And so the law about not taking human life, innocent human life, gives rise to all kinds of laws, right? Laws about how fast you can drive your car, you know, how you can shoot your car, your gun off in the city, and so on. And all kinds of things that, you know, are invented to protect human life, right? But they're all being fed by this one divine law. So if we say, you know, that the laws of Nazi Germany are bad because they don't agree with the laws of the United States of America, the Nazis say, well, your laws are off because they don't agree with our laws. Well, again, you have to go back to some kind of common law, some kind of natural law, some kind of divine law, in order to judge that our laws are better if they are than the laws of Nazi Germany. Huh? So that's a beautiful comparison that Heraclitus makes. Huh? So, I mean, you know, life on a college campus, you know, you've got to show up at the same time, the teacher and the students, right? They got to have some things in common, right? Huh? Common room we're going to meet, right? You know? And if one of you guys goes to one room to learn, I'll get another. It was kind of obvious, you know, but I mean, you know, there are subtle ways that you need something that we have in common. So, that's exactly what Aristotle, in a way, does in the metaphysics, right? Because he takes what's common to all men, the axioms, and defends them, right? And the words in the axioms, right, which are common to all men, we all use the words whole and part, right? We all use the word being, we all use the word one, and so on. And so you see, Aristotle's the only guy that understands these words. He's kind of the common doctor in a sense too, right? Mm-hmm. Because he understands better than other people the words that are common to all of us. Mm-hmm. And that's the kind of reason. I go back. I don't know, Thomas is tied into that tradition. Okay, I mentioned how in the I was looking at Thomas's little treatise on the called De Creaturi Spiritualibus, right? And in the 17th chapter there, where he speaks of Plato and Aristotle are the chief philosophers. But if you read the Consolation of Philosophy, you'll see that from Boethius, they are the chief philosophers. Huh? And now Plato, or Augustine seems to have known, you know, Plato rather than Aristotle, but he's always trying to follow Plato so far as he can, meaning in conformity with the Catholic faith, right? So these great minds, Albert the Great says the same thing. They take Plato and Aristotle as the chief philosophers. So, but again, you have to see in a sense how they got a distinct and ordered knowledge of what is common to all things. Huh? Mm-hmm. We're going to see that when you get into the 11th question here, right? 11th question. Just look at the first couple articles there. It's on the unity of God, right?
Yeah.
But before he gets to whether God is one, that's not to the third article, right?
Yeah.
And whether God is most one, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But he has some more general questions here. Mm-hmm. Whether one adds something above being, right?
Mm-hmm.
And whether the one and the many are opposed, and how they're opposed, right? Now, to my knowledge, Plato, I mean Aristotle really, and Thomas are the only real great philosophers who understood the most universal things, like being, one, good, true, right? And they were able to distinguish these, as you'll see Thomas distinguishing being and one here, but how they differ in meaning. But also you'll see the order among them, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And you'll see the same thing when he gets up talking about true, you know? Question 16, yeah. You'll be talking about true there in the first article, second article. And then in the third and fourth article, notice he says, about the comparison of true to being, and about comparison of true to good, right? Huh? Okay. So the distinction of being, thing, one, true and good, mm-hmm. and the order of those five, are very carefully thought out by Aristotle.
Mm-hmm.
And then they realize each one of those words is equivocal by reason, so they think out the distinction and the order of the meanings of each one of them, and they see the distinction between good and bad, true and false, one and many, being and unbeing, right? And the different kinds of opposites. Nobody else has done that, right? So what's most common, what's most universal, is understood distinctly in an ordered way by Aristotle and Thomas, and by nobody else, really, except if you got a little bit from them, you know, learned some of it from them. Okay.
Yeah.
And so, I think I mentioned before how you can't understand the less universal without understanding the more universal. Now, if you realize that, you realize that's true. You'll find this even in a definition. The parts of a definition are more universal than the thing being defined. So when I define a square as an equilateral and right-angled quadrilateral, right? Every part of that definition is said of more than square. And the genus especially, right? But even the difference is equilateral instead of square and rhombus, huh? Right angled instead of square and oblong. Quadrilateral instead of all of those plus some other things. But the combination is said only the square. So I'm understanding the less universal through the more universal.